my chance with crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make to have in the middle of it. Rest make to have in the middle. We are rest make to have.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Okay, what's coming up next would be David Yurth, and you'll hear Dr. John Apsley introduce him, and then we'll go from there on into the clip. This is very interesting, and so if you can pay close attention to it, David Yurth is the foremost expert, you could say, in the field of radiation remediation. So if you can pay close attention to what he has to say, you're really going to benefit. And he was also a co-master ceremonies during our Fukushima Solutions World Conference held on the university campus. We want to thank the Young American for Liberty for hosting us out there. And we feel that we really did expose some of the real essence of what's going on over there in Fukushima. There's continuous spilling forth of very highly radioactive, very dangerous particles. And so that is not stopping. And the people around the area there are being contaminated to a great degree. So it's not a pleasant thing to consider or even talk about. But we must talk about it and try to secure some kind of better understanding. The problem with radiation is that at a low level, it does not physically harmful initially. So being exposed to a low level that could harm you later on, several years later, because of ill health generated by the damage, the genetic damage, is not at first noticeable, both physically to the physical self, but also into the senses, I should say. So it's not like being burned by a fire and, oh my gosh, I'm pain right there. You're not going to experience pain on an exposure to low radiation poisoning, but it is there. It will cause damage. You have to really know and think about this before you can become wary of this thing called radiation poisoning. If you're not that aware of what's going on, you're going to just continue to ignore the real dangers that are there. I think Helen Caldicott a year or so ago said the very same thing in her own way, and in a much more professional, scientific way than I could actually set out here on our radio station. So it's something that's not apparent initially. An imminent danger is not realized or apparent or that noticeable. It does do harm to you and your genetic harm, and in especially women, it could cause deformity in children and so forth at birth. And this would be just a terrible thing for any woman to have to go through and undertake, having a very grossly deformed child. It's just a horrible thing for women to contemplate. They always say, is the child okay, you know, after the child is born? I know my mother said that about me and my brother and my sister. Is the child okay? And that meaning, is it all right? Is it okay? Is it healthy? Women are givers and nurturers of birth and of life, and givers and nurturers of life. So inherent deep within every woman is that need to give life and to promulgate life. And it's so inherently innate within women that when they give birth, they want to know that that child is okay. So that's basically the core of most women. And so, and as a result, you've got to start you know, waking up to this danger and trying to become more, less intellectual and more knowledgeable about the real dangers of it. Anyway, Dr. John Apsley will introduce shortly, David Yurt, and then he's going to just close out the end of the hour. So I hope you enjoyed. Thank you for listening to us this Saturday night in Austin, Texas. And we certainly appreciate each and every one of you. It's April 5th, 2014. Thank you very much for listening, and good night. I hope that you enjoy this program.
Our next speaker is our co-moderator, and David is an expert, one of the world's top experts in remediation of nuclear waste and nuclear materials. We're really quite fortunate that he was able to make it here and to share his enormous area of expertise. And there's probably only a handful of people in the world that can even come close to his understanding about how some of these actual final solutions to deal with the nuclear waste problem can be effectively dealt with.
Well, hi, everybody. Y'all going to sleep after lunch? put you right to sleep? All right. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about how to deal with getting rid of radioactive nuclear-propagating waste material. And I want to kind of set the stage for this by saying the state of science, big S, is in some disrepute these days, because there's a fundamental failure to understand the distinction, I think, between writing about science in fiction and not understanding that, in a very real sense, science is fiction. So let me illustrate my point. In 1895, Lord Byron said, "It is absolutely impossible for a heavier-than-air machine to fly carrying man as a passenger." And then along came the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk. And we see these kinds of pronouncements over and over and over. Ideas in science get refined by discovery. Science, in its most fundamental function, is really metaphorically represented by the 11 blind guys who are trying to describe an elephant to each other. Right? You understand the metaphor? That each one of them, from their own perspective, gets to touch it with their hands and smell it and do whatever. And as they try to describe it to their fellow investigators, their interpretation, their point of view, is all fundamentally different. So science has now been siloed into so many different little areas of very specific expertise where you know more and more about less and less. Everybody's trying to figure out what the things we observe mean and how they connect together. And the story we tell about it changes over time as the information we obtain becomes more refined and more reliable. Now, science has a real blind spot. Science, as big S, refers to the institution not remediate radioactive propagation by high-level nuclear waste in any meaningful, affordable, scientifically supportable way. That's the dictum of science. That's the doctrine of it. And it's absolutely false. If you go to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, uspto.gov, and you put a search term in there that has to do with radioactive remediation or radioactive transmutation, you'll find that in the last 5 years, more than 60 patents have been issued. That's just in the United States. There are over 600 patents issued worldwide. A friend of mine, a guy named Gary Vesperman, has just published a book that identifies all of the known legitimate means by which radioactive propagation in high-level nuclear fuel can be remediated. It's a 243-page book. And if you want a copy of it, get a hold of Gary Vesperman at his email. If you don't have it, talk to me afterwards and I'll give you his email address. It's the accumulation of about 30 years worth of work done in the private sector with like-minded people who have done really good work. Look, here's how it goes. Dr. Klein told you this morning that when you take fuel pellets made of uranium-235 and thorium-233, you put them inside a zirconium fuel rod, and because of the way they behave together, because of the decay cycle, they heat that rod up. It gets super hot. You dip it in water or you pass some kind of a fluid around it, and the water gets hot. And it gets hot enough, sometimes up in the 1,000 to 1,200 degrees centigrade range, it gets hot enough to melt most metals. So they have to use real special metals and materials inside these nuclear reactors in order to contain the pressures and the heat and deal with the thermionic stresses. After a while, about 15% into the life cycle of that zirconium fuel rod, something has happened that requires that fuel rod to be removed from the pile and put into the cooling pond. Any idea what that is? Anybody got any notions about that? I mean, if you drive an automobile, you fill up the tank and you only get to use 15% of the gas and you got to take the gas tank out, what's the problem? What's the problem? Again? No. Look. What is radioactive propagation? What is the emission cycle consist of? What is it? Well, it creates heat, but what's going on? You understand the dynamic of it? No. Here's what I'm trying to get to. If I take an atom of uranium-235, highly enriched, the nucleus is deliberately unbalanced. It has an unequal number of protons and neutrons. And because of the way that thing is structured, because of the refinement process and the way the orbitals operate with the electron fields, the only way this baby can seek to get to a lower, more comfortable, steady state energetically is to get rid of some pieces. The nucleus of a uranium-235 atom is not happy. Those unbalanced neutrons and protons do not play well with each other. And so they expel them. But when the neutrons come off, they're going very fast. A neutron has over 1,800 times the mass of an electron. And when it comes shooting out of the inside, breaking the strong nuclear force, it has a velocity of about 70% the speed of light. That is really fast. So you take a massive, heavy particle and you propel it at 70% light speed. What happens when it hits the nucleus of another atom? It just shatters it. It catastrophically shatters it. And what happens when you catastrophically shatter the nucleus of a neighboring uranium atom? It shoots off a whole bunch more neutrons. You've all seen the demonstration of the mouse traps and the ping pong balls sitting on top of the ping pong table. Well, the only way you can prevent that is by putting things in between those mouse traps to keep the balls from tipping each other over. And that's what the nuclear pile is all about. It mitigates, it moderates the number of neutrons that are allowed to impact other materials. Well, what about this zirconium tube? The reason they use zirconium is because under certain circumstances it is transparent to some of the emissions, but it contains others. Except that after about 15% of its life expectancy, when those neutrons hit more and more and more of the nuclei of the zirconium atoms that make up this very dense crystalline lattice called metal, what happens to the metal? You now have a phenomenon that is called neutron embrittlement. And neutron embrittlement then so sufficiently degrades the integrity of the tube that if they don't take that tube out of the pile before it's too late, the damn thing will come apart. Then you really have a problem, because then you've got a whole bunch of free particles an inch square flying around down inside the nuclear pile, made up of material that can't be moderated. It's free down there. But when it gets out of control and you get those fuel pellets all aggregated together in the bottom of a tank and it doesn't have any water left, what do you get? You get a core meltdown. And that's what's happened at Fukushima. They have a core meltdown there. Look, in 1984, at Savannah River, they began storing high-level liquid nuclear waste from their atomic power plants in stainless steel spheres, 20 feet in diameter, the wall thickness 2 feet thick. Within 10 years, by 1984, those stainless steel containers were leaking. Why were they leaking? Because it was bad stainless steel? No. Because neutron embrittlement had so thoroughly fractured the crystalline lattice that they no longer contained the fluid. And the fluid began to leak out onto the ground. So the Department of Energy awarded a contract to Westinghouse. And that contract, over a period of 8 years, consumed $465 million at last count, at which point Westinghouse announced, one, they had not succeeded in extracting 1 cubic centimeter of particulated matter out of the water. They pretended they were going to use all kinds of means to take the particles out of the water, but after 8 years, they said, well, we weren't able to do any. And if we can't do it, it's impossible. The next year, in 1994, it became departmental policy at the Department of Energy to encapsulate high-level nuclear waste material in vitrified ceramic materials so they could transport it across the country by truck and by train and bury it under Yucca Mountain in Nevada. Now, was it a coincidence that Westinghouse said that we can't fix it? Or was it a coincidence that Yucca Mountain came along just after they figured out that couldn't be done? Or after the scientific establishment made such a big brouhaha in the press about, you know, how they were going to solve this huge problem? We've got to contain this stuff inside vitrified ceramic, and we're just going to put it on trucks and trains and ship it across the country right through the middle of Main Street and take it to Nevada and bury it under the ground underneath the strata. Well, there's a little problem with that. The big guys are interested in doing it because it constitutes a $12 to $15 billion a year cash flow that was all part of the encapsulation and containment research and development process. What we now know 20 years later is that there is no material known to man of any description whatsoever that resists neutron embrittlement. And if you want any proof about that, just look at what happened at Carlsbad 2 months ago. Just look at what happened there. What they do in the industry, where they can get away with it, is they take high-level solid nuclear waste still in its zirconium fuel rod and they dip it in liquefied ceramic and they subject it to very high heat in an oven and they turn the ceramic into a glassine material. And that glassine material is supposed to be strong enough and dense enough, impervious enough to neutron bombardment, that it's supposed to last for 10,000 years. That was the scientific prediction. Fact of the matter is that that strategy is what was used on the fuel rods and high-level nuclear material that was stored at Carlsbad, and after 10 years it was so structurally degraded by neutron bombardment that when a portion of the salt fell on it, it fractured those glassine encapsulation tubes, and now that storage facility is so hot, so radioactively hot, that they can't even send robots down there because the gamma rays and the neutron bombardment level is so high that it destroys the CCD chips in their cameras and fries the components in their computers. The robots won't work. Human beings certainly can't go in there. There's 40,000 tons of that stuff stored under the ground in the salt mines in Carlsbad, New Mexico. If it ever needed a good reason to know why you shouldn't bury stuff under the ground like that, why it's absolutely suicidal, there's a case in point. So we've got a real serious problem. We got two kinds of high-level nuclear waste. We've got the stuff that's already been produced that they're supposed to be storing somewhere, and they've got stuff that is being produced every day. What do you do with a situation like Fukushima or Chernobyl? We have no technologies. We have no equipment. There is no machinery known to man that can handle that material safely and dispose of it by any means once it's been released. Once the feathers are in the wind, we've got a problem, and it is not solvable using existing technology. Stuff that is being currently stored is a candidate for remediation. There's a very deep pocket out there that is resistive to this. Now, there are several deep pockets that are resistive to the idea of actually remediating the emissions produced by high-level fuel. One of them is the people that get paid to store it. One of them is the military. They use the waste material produced by public utilities that are supposed to be providing power for the public. They use that as the feedstock from which they then further refine weapons-grade plutonium. That violates federal law, and it violates international treaties, and it's not supposed to be done, but it's going on, and because those guys are the big 500-pound gorillas on the playing field, anybody who wants to solve that problem who has a legitimate technology to really effectively address the problem has some real serious consequences. And I have a personal story I'm going to relate to you about that. Between 1994 and 2002, a bunch of people in Salt Lake City, Utah, put together a laboratory, used a very specific technology called high-density charge clusters, invented by a guy named Ken Shoulders. He got a patent for it in 1991, got six more patents after that. But the idea of a high-density charge cluster is that under the right conditions, if you use the right kind of a probe and the right kind of power supply and the right kind of environment, you can shoot electrons out the end of a spark generator, and those electrons, instead of dispersing away from each other like bees in a windstorm, like you'd expect them to do, actually create little donuts, little toruses of a very specific diameter. When that torus is then guided by a magnetic field through a proton-rich environment, something like deuterium gas, deuteride gas, which is chock-a-block full of free protons, the little torus, because it's made of electrons, highly negatively charged in the center, attracts protons into the center of this little torus. And it actually picks them up and carries them into a target. When they impact the target, because the protons have such high relative mass, at about 10% light speed, there's enough energy, kinetic energy, like a bullet or a bowling ball. There's enough energy when those things strike the nuclei of the target material that they disrupt it temporarily, not catastrophically, like a high-speed neutron, not like a rifle bullet into an ice cube, but more like a ping-pong ball shot out of a marshmallow gun into Jell-O. And what it does is temporarily disrupt the nuclear structure you get some neutrons coming off, you get some protons coming off, you get a lot of electrons freed up because the orbitals are disrupted, you get gamma. And then they come back together. But when they come back together, the half-life is cut by 50%. So cesium-137 bombarded by high-density charge clusters in a deuterium environment, you reduce in one bombardment, you reduce the half-life from 30 years to 15 years. And then to 7.5, and then to 3.75, and then whatever. And so over successive iterations of this stuff, just by using the right kind of high-powered pulse electrical current in the right kind of an environment, you can take that stuff, feed it through a tube, blast it with electricity, and eliminate, absolutely eliminate, radioactive emissions right down to ambient background levels. You have an inert material. We did that. We did it for 11 years. And we made it work in both solid and liquid nuclear waste under controlled conditions. We were good scientists. We had a good thesis. We had good apparatus. We took good notes. We conducted our experiments under controlled conditions. We took all the information, put it into our records, and then one day we got an invitation from the Department of Energy to share our data with them. We thought, rock and roll, baby, now they're finally starting to pay attention. So we packaged all of our stuff up, put a nice cover on it, it passed the federal weight test, and we sent it to the Department of Energy. And they turned around and sent it to some government labs, and a year later we were informed that the government laboratories had independently verified not only our results but our technique. And so we thought we were going to be invited to participate in a process of actually implementing the design, engineering, prototyping, testing, and deployment of alpha and beta additions for on-site field testing to remediate nuclear waste. That's what they told us was going to happen. And they lied. In 2005, in October, I got a phone call from the guy at DOE who is responsible by law, under charter, he's responsible for directing the department who's specifically charged with solving this problem. He screamed so loud that I had to hold the phone away from my head. Spencer Abraham, the Secretary of the Department of Energy, had called him on the phone, took him into his office, sat him down, and informed him in no uncertain terms that unless he got our stuff out of their files and stopped us from engaging in doing our research, the guy was going to lose his job. 3 PhDs, he'd been there 31 years. So, under threat of professional assassination from within the agency, he called and screamed at me. And when I told him to go pound sand, then he told me that if I persisted, I and my cohorts would be arrested under FISA and imprisoned without representation. And further, unless we agreed to desist, they were going to serve us with national secrecy orders. So, when your head's in the lion's mouth, what do? You know, you try to find a way to back out. And so, for 5 years, we dropped that ball and walked away from that project and did nothing more. And then in 2010, I got a phone call. It was a new administration. Obama was now the president. Dr. Yu was now the secretary of the Department of Energy. Change of mind, change of heart, change of plan. Yucca Mountain no longer officially the agency agenda, although it has nevertheless continued to be developed at an unabated rate. Got a phone call. Went to Washington, sat down with a guy who's the perennial career bureaucrat, personal private assistant to each new secretary from the private sector who comes in to run the bureau. I'm not going to give you his name because he's a friend of mine. He said, look, I heard what happened to you. I told him the story. I showed him the documents. I played him a recording of the telephone conversation. He was appalled. He sent me a letter, apologized on behalf of the United States government and the Department of Energy, apologized for the way we'd been treated, and invited me to put a presentation together for a private presentation to all 26 department heads for the Department of Energy in their office building in Washington, D.C. So we worked through the summer to put this presentation together. 3 weeks before the presentation was scheduled to occur, I got an email from him on his private email expressing his regrets about the fact that he had been left no political alternative but to cancel the conference because he was getting such extraordinary heat from his department heads, they didn't even want to have the conversation, much less have it be a matter of record in the department that that conversation had even occurred. In 2010. So, you know, the inmates are running the asylum here. Private interest and their capital are protecting their territory, their economic and political territory, by preventing the technologies that are available from actually being used and getting them into the marketplace. And that's not right. That's not right. Because not only is it not good for us as citizens, but it's not good for the planet we live on. The planet we live on is being despoiled permanently by a kind of waste material that is not justifiable. So, can we solve the problem? Yes, we can. We can solve the problem. I know personally, from the work we've done in our laboratories, of four different methods for remediating nuclear waste that are absolutely effective, that produce no contaminating waste stream, and that solve the problem. Gary Vesperman's book talks about 24 more, and the U.S. Patent Office has 60 patents that are addressed to the subject. So don't tell me that we can't solve the problem. We can solve the problem. We understand the physics of it. The way the physics of it is described in the standard physical model is not correct. We know that because our experimental evidence proves it's not correct, and we're not the only ones. I've got 15 papers in my archives by scientists from other countries in the European Economic Union, and more from the Russian Academy of Sciences. The Russians are way ahead of us on this subject. Not only do they know what to do, they know how to do it, and they have been doing it. They just finished a project in 2011, published a paper. They totally remediated 1,500 cubic meters of high-level radioactive nuclear waste and published the report. And you didn't hear about it on the 10 o'clock news. In fact, they couldn't get it published in the mainstream scientific organs, so they open-sourced their report. So, it's not that the problem can't be solved. It can be solved. What you have to be able to do, using whatever technology you bring to bear, is this. When you have an unhappy atom, and it's spitting off protons and neutrons and electrons and gamma rays and all kinds of stuff, you've got to find a way to relieve the stress. There are lots of ways to do that. We can do it with plasmas. We can do it with magnetic fields. We can do it with cryogenics. We can do it with a variety of different kinds of methods. You got to give it away to relieve the stress temporarily so that when the pieces come back together, they can be in a happy, steady state and not be reactive. Well, you know, this is the 21st century. That's not rocket science. We know exactly what to do. If it were done properly, if we really paid attention, and radioactive nuclear waste could be handled real time as it's produced on site using a safe and effective method, think about what that would mean for energy production in the world. There is an alternative. In 1954, one of the fathers of the atomic age, Edward Teller, published a paper and obtained a patent. He designed what was called a liquid sodium thorium reactor. The reactors that Dr. Klein described to you this morning operate in the plus or minus 1,000 degrees centigrade temperature range. That's almost 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That's really hot. Thorium is an alternative material that, like uranium, goes through a decay cycle. But unlike uranium, it does not go through a decay cycle at a high enough rate that it'll become self-sustaining. It can't go critical. It cannot. And that is why most of the fuel rods that are being used today in these high-temperature gas-cooled nuclear reactors are about 60% uranium and 40% thorium. They take inert thorium, which is the fifth most abundant material in the surface of the Earth. All over Texas, when they drill holes in the ground and they bring up the mud, 3 to 5% of that mud is radioactive. It's called normally occurring radioactive mud. It's thorium. It's everywhere. It's the reason the core of the planet stays hot, because it's part of the nuclear family. And it's one of the reasons we have gravity and a whole bunch of other things that happen on this planet. Well, thorium's some pretty interesting stuff. Dr. Otis Peterson has had a liquid sodium thorium reactor that produces 10 megawatts of power, operating for 11 years at INEEL in Idaho. Absolutely without incident. Its operating temperature is 200 degrees centigrade, which means you don't need cooling towers, you don't need liquid mercury, you don't need pressurized containment vessels, you don't need any of the exotic materials, you don't have any of the risk of explosion, any of the risk of high-level radioactive stuff being spewed into the environment or leaked into the groundwater. You build one of these things according to Teller's design, put it in a 40-foot freight container, and put that baby 300 feet under the ground and leave it there for 300 years till you figure out what to do with what's left over. In 300 years, we ought to be able to figure this out. But in the meantime, that unit, that's as safe as it can possibly be, emits nothing into the atmosphere, can create enough power to supply most small towns. 10 megawatts of power is a lot of power. Right? 1,000, 1,500 houses in the United States and other places add a zero to that because they don't use power like we do. Continuous. On demand. Local. Safe. Affordable. The Chinese are building them now by the dozens. They just created an initiative in 2012. They dedicated $500 million to the proposition of creating thorium-powered energy generating systems of the kind I just described to you. The Chinese are building them now, and they will work. And at some point, they'll stop building coal-fired plants, and all their little towns and villages and factories and machine shops will all be powered by thorium. That's happening. We're at least 50 years behind the curve, because the economic interest that's served by the nuclear fuel industry is now being used as a way of protecting economic and political territory rather than serving the needs of the people. So it's not that the problem can't be moderated. It can. It's not that we can't solve the problem of what to do with the waste. We can. It's not that we don't know what to do to prevent the waste from being as dangerous as it is. We do. What has to happen is that the people on the bleachers with the noisemakers and the pom-poms need to figure out how to get on the field. And we're working on it. This conference is part of that process. So, you know, I've been at this game a long time. I have a little privately owned research institute. We pal up with good scientists and good engineers from all over the world who have really great ideas. And, you know, we publish our papers together. We share our information together. We open source it on the internet together. We address conferences like this together. We do everything we can to amplify the effect of the work that each of us does by pooling our work together and hoping that it'll be supplemental and amplifying in some way. But yeah, we can solve the problem. Fukushima is another issue. You understand now what the dimensions of the problem are. You understand what the dimensions of the problem are now that the water at this 400 tons a day is being run past this nuclear material and then dumped into the Pacific Ocean is a real problem. In May of 2013, it was reported that a 600-pound bluefin tuna was caught and brought in, weighed, and inspected. They discovered that it was so contaminated by radioactive cesium with the Fukushima signature that it literally had to be destroyed. It took about a year and a half, 2 years, for that great big fish to swim through the Fukushima waste plume, make its way around through the North Pacific and down the coast and get caught. Now we're getting reports nearly weekly of similar events with all kinds of deep water fish. So before you buy fish that come out of the Pacific Ocean, you be doggone careful about where they came from. Make darn sure that the fish you're buying came out of the Atlantic or the Gulf or some other place, but not out of the Pacific, because that place is now becoming unbearably contaminated. You want to be real careful. And if you do find out that you've ingested contaminated deep sea fish, you want to get a hold of John over here and make sure that you start doing the right stuff to get that stuff out of your body, because you don't want to do that anymore. So I don't want to paint a bleak picture for you, but I want to tell you flat out that what's going on with the nuclear industry now, the notion of green nuclear energy, has about as much validity as military intelligence. It's the same kind of oxymoron. You know, it just cannot be. In its current state, nuclear power is insane. It's absolutely, categorically, unequivocally, unacceptably insane. And it has to be stopped until we can find a way to treat the waste. Once we get an effective waste treatment program, and we demonstrate the technology, and we get it deployed as a matter of government policy, so that it cannot be resisted by other economic and political interests, then we can start talking about creating nuclear power. But until then, we got to look at other alternatives. Any questions?
Yeah, could y'all line up at the microphone for questions? We've got a few minutes here.
Thank you, Dr. Yerb.
Hi.
So, one of my questions was, you talked about Carlsbad, New Mexico, briefly. Mm-hmm. Is that the same accident that occurred this past week in Los Alamos? Is that the same one? And
no.
Perhaps it's not.
No.
It's two different ones.
No. Carlsbad is a military waste storage facility in southeastern New Mexico.
Okay. Have you heard about the one in Los Alamos?
I'm not familiar with it. I've seen the headlines, but I haven't investigated it.
Oh, yeah. My question was in regards to that.
Nope. Don't know about those guys.
Regarding the Carlsbad emissions, I have seen evacuation plans that could possibly correlate to the evacuation due to that. And it covers 14 million people all the way down to Midland, Odessa, El Paso, et cetera. Have you seen those types of projections that could potentially occur?
I haven't paid any attention to that stuff.
Okay. Do you think there's any validity?
Well,
could we be looking at that?
There's an issue here. They're getting heat because it's endangering public safety.
The very few who even have a clue.
You know, that it's endangering public safety. The extent to which it legitimately can be said to endanger public safety is not something we know, because we're not getting good, reliable, uncensored information.
So the radiation exposures, Dr. Apsley, that you're about to go over, are you being able to detect if it's Fukushima or Carlsbad?
Yes, they have different signatures.
And are we seeing both?
Yes, we're seeing both.
Okay, but the good news of the day is that there is a means. There are many means.
There are many means by which it can be done.
So once again, we are talking about the obstruction of decency and protection of the people due to corporate profits. Is that accurate?
I think it's more broadly characterized than that. It's not just corporate profit. The nuclear issue has everything to do with agendas that deal with the government's right to secrecy, that deal with the extent to which the government is being used by the people who are supposed to be regulated as a way of protecting their own political and economic interest. When I say that the inmates are running the asylum, I'm not kidding, because the Department of Energy is specifically charged with the responsibility for finding a way to solve this problem. And anytime anybody gets too close to solving the problem, they disenfranchise them.
Well, that pressure's coming from somewhere.
Well, the pressure's coming from the people who are benefiting in one way or another from the proliferation of the current set of practices.
Corporate.
Well, some of it's corporate, some of it's private, some of it's national, some of it's international.
The aspect that corporations are people, so their First Amendment right of speech is
expressed
through money.
Corporations are not people. I'm
sorry. Giving to politicians. Now, this is kind of a little bit off subject, but I've just watched a documentary called Move to Amend, and it's coming up in 2016 about getting an amendment to our Constitution that says corporations are not people. Human beings are people that have the sanctity of the rights of our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and that does not apply to corporations.
Well,
so do you think that would be beneficial if we got
well,
that?
Well, my personal opinion is that where government is responsible for regulation, mm-hmm. where it's responsible for regulating aviation or commerce or any of the other things that are supposed to contribute to the common defense and our benefit and our welfare, whenever those interests are privately controlled or manipulated or exploited in a way that is undisclosed and that is preferential, then it's government's responsibility to stop it. The fact of the matter is, my personal opinion is, this government is so broken I don't think it can be fixed. But, you know, that remains to be seen. Look, I worked in the Nixon White House. I was a lobbyist in the state legislature for 10 years. I've written bills that have passed into law. My personal opinion is that this system is broken. And one of the reasons it's broken is because money has become allowed as the means by which private agendas get ascendancy and primacy over the public benefit and welfare. And that's not right. That's not what was intended. And I don't know of anybody that's got enough juice to fix it.
We do.
Well,
but we've got good to be activated.
Go ahead on.
Hey, Dave,
yeah.
One point. Jerry Besselman updated those three papers.
Yep.
For us. They're on our website.
If you'll post them on your website.
They're already
awesome.
There.
Yep. Okay.
Come into FukushimaSolutions.com. You'll get all those latest ones.
Rock on.
So I have a question, David. You've got the technology, right?
We do.
And it could amazingly clean up the environment. Why not partner with some company that needs some cleanup and just go do it and show it?
Well, there are a couple of questions there. One is, do we have access to the material in order to prove up our prototypes? In order to prove that it works with high-level radioactive material, you got to have some. And what was made clear to us and has been made unequivocally clear to others is that unless you operate with the open and acknowledged support of the U.S. Department of Energy and the Nuclear a regulatory commission, you do not have access to the materials. So we were specifically blacklisted. We can't get our hands on it, even in laboratory quantities, for testing and development. Second question is related to the research and development process. In order for us to build devices, systems, that by one means or another take radioactive material and treat them in a certain way and produce inert materials out the other end, we've got to have capital, right? I mean, this is a pretty expensive proposition. If it was a government contract, it would be in the $500 million to $1.5 billion range on a 10-year project. If we do it privately, we'd probably do it for $10 million on a 5-year run. We've got the budget. We know what to do. problem is that 96% of the radioactive material in the world is controlled by the United States government, either by ownership, through agencies, or by treaties and agreements. The other 4% are controlled by countries that are on the terrorist list, including the Russians. So we can't go there with our technology and do our research and development in those political jurisdictions without being put on the terrorist list, because we're exporting information that's vital to national security. So, you know, we're affirmatively stopped by the refusal of access and the denial. And so we've tried to do this on our own. I mean, we literally bootstrapped this testing process for 11 years out of a brown paper bag in our back pocket. And we literally spent our fortunes trying to figure out how to do this, and it worked. And our fortunes are gone, and so is our opportunity. And that's just the real world. Well, that's the real world. That's where we live.
Okay. I believe you mentioned a process that talks about taking advantage of the nuclear resonance.
Speak up, please.
You know, like magnetic resonance.
Mm-hmm.
And using using that to, like illuminate it with electrons and energies at such levels that will excite the nucleus to the point where it will prematurely or... well, anyway, just eject the extra material, the unstable elements, particles within it, to drop them.
There are some magnetic resonance techniques that have been tried and shown to be effective, yes.
Okay, and it seems to me you could just take thorium itself and stick it in that thing, because the energy going in to emit
it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't quite work that way.
No, radionuclides, heavy atoms of radioactive nuclear material, they're big, they're heavy. They're cumbersome. The chemistry of radionuclides is abominably difficult. So unless you've got real special laboratories and special equipment and special training and special people, you just can't even go there.
This is a simple question. You had mentioned that the Chinese are building thorium energy plants now.
They are.
Now the cat's out of the bag. What prevents us from competing in that arena, or is this still one of those political alliance problems you were talking about?
Look, technology, first, last, and always, is an instrument of social and cultural engineering, right?
Mm-hmm.
You engineer the way your culture works based on the technology you have available.
That's the way it works.
In this country, because we operate from a basis under which freedom of speech is deemed to be equivalent to buying whatever influence you can afford, then the political and economic interests you protect with your exercise of your free speech protect your interests. It doesn't have anything to do with what's good for the people. It has to do with enhancing shareholder value and the 90-day profit and loss statements. And that's how it works here. In China, it's a different matter. In China, they now view themselves in the technology process as coming into their own entitlement to do whatever they need to do to become prime in the market. And it's not a democracy. And this feudal time warp that they're caught in between warlords and limited capitalism gives the ruling party a way to exploit every technology that's available to satisfy their means. Look, the Chinese government 2 years ago completed the construction and population of a brand new high-tech research and development facility in Taipei, in Taiwan. They spent $22 billion on the facilities and equipment, and before they opened the door, it was fully populated. They are doing the best research and development on the planet in that facility with the smartest people, with the most money, and the best instrumentation and equipment, and we're sucking gas because we're not doing R&D unless it can be turned into military weapons. That's where R&D money comes from in this country. So if you're not in the establishment and you're not weaponizing your technology, you can't get money to do good technology development in the private sector. It's gone. $3.6 trillion went out of the economy in the late 90s when the dot-com bubble burst. Another $2.5 trillion just went out of the economy starting in September of 2008. So we're upside down $6 trillion in this country, which was all the pool that was available to do all the research and development that we've needed to be able to do to stay abreast of things. If you want to do nanotechnology work, anything in serious carbon-based nanotechnology, you better speak Japanese, because they own that world. They are 10 full years ahead of our best work.
All right. I've seen the research. I've been following some of this, so I know that's the problem. Just to bring it down to a more simplistic level, is there something communities can do to pull back and take care of themselves?
Well, look, communities can't engage in nuclear remediation. They can't, because we have a centralized distribution grid, and the means of production are owned by the public utilities. And if you can't moderate what happens with the public utilities, all you get to deal with are the consequences. It forces us to be reactive. In a congressional setting where they can't even agree what time to open the doors to the Senate office building, much less pass meaningful legislation, the likelihood that anybody's material interest is going to be interrupted by bilateral political concern about the public welfare is not very likely. So what we're trying to do in our own efforts is embark on a different path. We've made some excellent relationships with private capital, some of it from within the United States, some of it from outside the United States, that is being made available as quiet, patient, private, long-suffering, essentially invisible money that enables us to do our work, do it in private, stay off the radar, and bring our solutions to the marketplace in a way that doesn't take us across the same fields of fire that normal technology stuff has to go through. And we do that because we really don't have an alternative. We know how the establishment plays. We know what they do. We know how they play. We know their agendas. We know their tactics. And it's got
okay,
these teeth marks.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, sure, thanks. Thanks.
Yes, I was just going to ask, of the five new nuclear facilities that they're building, are they using the 1954 thorium technique, or is this the standard technique?
No, the new nuclear power plants that are actually being built now in China are...
In the United States.
In the United States? I have no idea. I haven't really followed them. I mean, the emerging technology for nuclear fission-powered... generators in the United States, it's all of a set piece. And whether they use single or double cooling towers or whether they, whatever, I mean, they do use fuel rods that are moderated
just
by thorium.
Small variations of the same technology.
But the technology really hasn't changed. I mean, the same guys are drawing research money from the same federally funded food trough for the last 40 years, and that's one of the reasons why nobody else has a chance to get involved, because they have preferred privileged access to that kind of money.
Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Go ahead.